Hey, we got donuts today.
Yeah, where did these donuts come from?
It's from the Slay Brothers.
They brought us donuts.
I think they just had them delivered.
I mean, we've done this like 20 something times though, and they've never brought donuts.
I know that. That's why that's a little weird.
I think it bodes well.
Today's episode is brought to you by Slay House Publishing. Recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
This is Slay House Publishing presents Lit Bits, and this is our final episode of the season. We are going to take a little break after this.
Really exciting to get here. I mean, we've done a lot of work.
We have done a lot of work.
A lot of work, a lot of research, a lot of reading, a lot of script writing.
The writing.
A lot of recording.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we're going to start by talking about themes and craft of the book. And I always like to, even though I know about themes and themology and thematicism,
mm-hmm.
I always like to defer to Trevor in this part of the discussion because I feel like he has a really strong grasp on this. And then Curtis and I can just kind of jump in and make jokes and
I'll just sit here and kind of go,
we'll be the color commentators.
Yeah, I mean, man, Bram Stoker's Dracula. What a novel, for sure. I think what's interesting to me about Dracula is that he's doing multiple things with this book, right? As we've kind of discussed, he's exploring some of his life, you know, kind of vicariously through the way he structures this novel and the characters we interact with in this novel. But I think he's also reflecting on the times that he was living through.
It's very much a social commentary.
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, like social commentary ends up being one of the strongest themes or the strongest allegories in this story. Because we have a character of Dracula who represents this old world, right? He's this ancient presence. And the first part of the novel is all Jonathan Harker talking to Dracula. Like, he goes out to visit Dracula because Dracula, I think, is looking to buy some estates in London.
Mm-hmm.
And Harker's, I think he's a not a realtor like what we would think. He's a lawyer, like an estate lawyer, right?
Right.
And so he goes out to talk to Dracula about this stuff and runs into all of the horrors of, like, Dracula's hospitality, which I think is, we use the term loosely, right?
Yeah.
But as he encounters this Dracula, and then Dracula moves to England, which at this point in time, I think we can see as kind of, it's not Paris, but it's becoming rapidly more industrialized. It's kind of a symbol, I think, of the new century, right? Or symbol of progress, if you will.
I think it's a symbol of industrialization. And also, I think from our discussion on Bram Stoker, we talked about the importance of London, especially to a literary figures, including those, especially those coming from Ireland.
Well, so I make it,
Irish
I make
authors
a comparison,
had to go to London.
I make a comparison to Paris just because I think that Paris for a lot of the world was like the symbol of Western civilization, like a symbol of Western industrialization and modernization.
Right.
At least in terms of culture, I would agree.
Yes, yeah. Right, yeah. And I think that, I mean, it was like the jewel of Western, not necessarily civilization, but Western modernization, right, was Paris. But I think London was growing as an industrial center and was growing as this kind of, in this urban identity, right? This very modern city that was representative, I think, of European modernization.
Well, and following in that direction of like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and Madame Blavatsky, he shows the East invading in on the West. And he shows the West as this scientific, as this industrial area. And the East is very full of mythology
kind of this
and magic.
Mysticism.
And mysticism.
Which I think is, I think that's fairly normal for a lot of writers at this time. You look at anything in the 19th century, And I mean, maybe even prior, but especially in 19th century horror fiction, there's a lot of preoccupation of like Eastern mysticism. And I think some of it is because writers at this time are trying to grapple with their cultural identities to set their traditions apart from traditions in other other parts of the world.
Right.
And so there is this kind of, I mean, call it a supremacist, effort to basically say the West is symbolic of Westernization, modernization, industrialization, and East is like this, I call it a mysticism, but I think it's also an intent to describe them as less developed, right? A lesser developed,
like a relic
world.
Of the past, right?
Exactly. Yeah. There are
it's exactly opposite here in the U.S.
Yeah, I think there are some cultural influences here too, because we have, imperialization was a really important force in the 19th century, going into the 20th century, especially if you're in Britain. You know, you think about Britain's relationship with building empire in Africa, building empire in China, building empire in India, right? Mm-hmm. Because in the 19th century, I mean, they were invading India pretty hard.
Sure.
I think that all of these, you know, forces would sit poorly with you, or may not sit as well with you, if you aren't trying to construct some kind of narrative about why you have a cultural imperative to imperialize these countries anyway.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And like, I don't think, here's the thing. So I know I talked a little bit about Powers of Darkness last episode.
Yeah.
And I know we talked about how Powers of Darkness is more than probably, since its structure is so vastly different and it weighs heavier on the historical figure of Dracula, that it probably doesn't, it probably works off of an older version of the manuscript than the one that got published eventually.
Sure.
I don't think everything with what you're saying with regard to imperialization, I don't think this is a pro-imperialist novel.
And I don't want to necessarily say that Stoker himself was a pro-imperialist or something
right,
like that.
Right.
I don't know enough about him. And I think that the biography we kind of went over doesn't necessarily suggest that. But I do think
I think it suggests against it, given his more liberal kind of policies and
Politics. Well, again, liberalism in the 19th century is not liberalism in the 20th century.
Exactly. But I think the other thing they can point to this too is because of his changing everything when he learns about the historical figure of Dracula, this is also a commentary on Dracula. And we talked about how it's interesting that, like, for in Vlad Dracula's time, he was part of the West and the East was the Ottoman Empire and the Turks pushing in on this.
Right.
So the boundaries kind of shifted by the time.
Right. The shift to push him as kind of more of an Eastern mysticism.
But Dracula, the character in the novel, acts like, and there are passages even in the published version that talks about how he felt betrayed because Vlad Dracula was betrayed by, you know, the Wallachian princes. He was betrayed by his own boyars. He was betrayed by people. I think that betrayal historically plays into this, and I think it plays against even Vlad Dracula as this fighter of imperialism.
Well, I think it's also Dracula himself is an interesting figure, because if we are talking about him being, you know, representative of Eastern mysticism, I think it's really interesting that he tries to become a modern Englishman. Right. I mean, like, he owns property in London. He moves to London, I think, with the intent of staying in London. Right. Of like transitioning over into this modern world. So in a way, he becomes this this transitional figure. Right. Like trying to reach from this, you know, call it a mystic past or a mysticist past. Right. Into a more modern future. And then if like the modern world's inability to like, or incompatibility with him, right? Because he wants to come in and eat people, and that's not necessarily what polite people want.
The mutilation and all that.
Yeah.
You know. You may not come to impel you?
He's like,
what is this country coming to? I can't impale anymore.
Do you know what year it is? We don't impale.
What is this then, this fair, this corn dog? You impaled this corn dog.
This corn dog.
This corn dog.
I feel like, yeah, I think what this...
I like that in this talk, his example. The corn dog is like the exemplary food of the modern world, right?
Yeah.
What is this stage performer's hand doing if not impaling the ventriloquist dummy and making him talk? That is exactly what I did when I was in Romania.
Impaling is happening all around you and you don't even see it.
Look at Oscar Wilde. He impales nightly. So,
oh, no.
You like impale.
I think what this allows us to do, because he pulls from a historical figure, he allows us to create these parallels between these different cultures and between these different like periods in history.
Yeah.
And we can reflect on them because they are both patriarchal. Like,
oh, sure.
London was just as patriarchal as Romania in Vlad Dracula's time.
And I think in a way, I mean, Stoker is kind of digging into like the difference, just the change in modernization, you know, over the course of the century he lived in.
Yeah.
You know, I find it just really interesting that we have such a preoccupation on like the place for magic in an increasingly literate, increasingly scientific world, right?
Yeah.
He seems to suggest that these two things are antithetical, right? They can't exist together.
Does
in the
he,
same
though?
Space.
That's well, the question.
But that's,
I'm gonna...
I think that's what's so interesting, because like Dracula himself cannot fit into the modern world. There's no real place for him. He comes in.
He tries. It's not for lack of trying.
He does try, but he's like very quickly we find like now he's eating people, and like that's not, we're not going to sit for that. He's got to be eradicated before the end of the novel. But then there's Van Helsing, who comes in as this like learned man, right? This person who is very well versed in the science, the scientific side of things, but also very well versed in like the religious or the mystical side of things.
Right.
And he seems to suggest like, no, you know, we can't necessarily push science forward if we lose the sense of the mystical, the right. religious. Right?
Well, we learn that as the novel, as they chase Dracula back to Romania, because as they get into towards his castle, all of a sudden we lose, like, as much as he doesn't fit in the Western culture, science and that intellectualized thinking and stuff don't fit as we retreat back into...
They can't figure out... I mean, so much of the book is them trying to figure out what is going on.
I would almost put
Mina
Dracula
Harker.
like the antithesis of Dracula would be like Dr. Seward, who is very analytical, who is very scientific.
Mm-hmm.
And then Van Helsing straddles between the line between the two. He's like, well, you can't have one without the other. You have to have both.
Yeah, there's got to be some kind of like a counterbalancing. I do think that it's also interesting.
Which
that
I wish my doctors still would do.
Because I think
that.
Dr. Seward was. I don't know. It could be COVID. It could also be like you have a curse.
Yeah.
I don't know. I did some bloodletting the other day at my doctor's office. he's still pretty in touch with, you know, what works.
Yeah. Yeah.
I go for my monthly leeches, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Pairing leeches with bloodletting is like, whoa, that's intense.
You could see God real fast.
Yeah. You start tasting weird things and the room seems weird. But man, it works.
No, I mean, to your point, I think it's also interesting that Dr. Seward and Van Helsing do seem to be of different generations in this book.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like Van Helsing is very much like older.
Mm-hmm.
More learned, and then Dr. Seward is much younger. I think that the book definitely grapples just with, I think the weight of change in the 19th century, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think this speaks back to my thesis, which we'll get back to in a few minutes, but I think the complexity of the culture, the complexity of the things that he's saying in this novel, even about femininity and about sexuality and gender roles, he flips the gender roles.
Well,
I feel like.
How does he flip the gender roles?
So.
Because I think this is still very patriarchal.
No. It is very, very patriarchal. But the fluid is received by the man. For instance, like Dracula drinks the blood, he takes the fluid into his body.
But it's predatory.
It is very predatory. It's very, in fact, there's a scene in there, I think it's in early on when Dracula first gets to England and Lucy's being attacked, I think Mina mm-hmm. sees this out in the yard, like in the courtyard. And what she sees is like, it's almost that Shakespearean beast with two backs thing.
Right.
But I think she envisions or pictures like a wolf on top of Mina, which is very predatory. It's a disturbingly... I mean, it's also...
Yeah, it's really very disturbing. It's very transgressive too.
Yeah,
I think one of the things. So the reason why I don't necessarily know that they reverse the gender roles, because I think that would mean that I think the woman would have to be the aggressor or the transgressor and not the man.
I don't think in that sense, but I think there are some reversals of gender stereotypes or gender kind of characteristics. I think Barbara Bedford does a really good job of explaining some of this better than I do. And her book really goes into a little bit better than what I can. But there's this idea that that women and men, like Mina, instead of it being a man to counteract Dracula towards the end of the novel, the men aren't, the men are kind of this collective that goes after him, but it's really Mina is leading this charge. It's her hypnotic connection, her mental psychic connection with Dracula that's leading it. She's the one that really becomes the central figure in this story. And she becomes one of the stronger figures. And I don't think that was as done in that time period as any other.
When you say that she's one of the stronger figures, like, what do you mean by that? Because I have a very different idea of Mina Harker.
Like, I don't see her as a two-dimensional figure at all. I see her as a very developed.
I wouldn't call her necessarily two-dimensional. But right. I don't know about, like, strong. I worry a lot about Mina's agency in this book. Because as soon as she meets Dracula, right, and Dracula starts to seduce her, she just kind of falls into alignment with Dracula. I mean, she chases after Dracula, not necessarily because she's looking to kill Dracula, but because she's compelled to follow him, right?
Yeah.
And I think that the men follow Mina in an effort to go kill him to protect her from...
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
...from Dracula's influence. Now, I can't remember who actually manages to drive the spike into Dracula. Is it...
It's not Quincy, the Texan, because he's killed. He's the one of the group
right.
that's killed.
Yeah, he gets
a mortal shot off, I think,
right.
that wounds Dracula. And then I think it's a collective effort. I think they just, because he's got his gypsies with him too. That's helping him fight while he's.
Well, and so this is one of the reasons why I just, you know, Mina seems to me to
Wasn't
be
it
the
Mina?
Victim.
Didn't Mina kill him?
I almost feel like it's Mina who does drive the stake into him, but I can't remember exactly. It's been.
I remember in the Francis Ford Coppola version in the movie.
Like, look this up.
We should while I'm talking and rambling incoherently, would somebody look up the novel and tell me who kills him? But I remember in the Francis Ford Coppola version, when he made his film, his movie based on this, mm-hmm. It's Mina that follows him into the castle and drives the stake. And then I think she takes the sword and cuts his head off. And I felt like
that's interesting.
That was more of an elaborate death scene for him than what was presented in the novel, but
right.
basically it followed the novel. I thought she was the one that killed him in the novel.
I mean, it's
which was why I was going about this idea that it was that helped swap the, you know.
So I think
redefine
for me when I read this book and reflect on this book. I think what stands out to me is like Dracula is a very predatory figure, right?
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
I think that we can't necessarily divorce Dracula's predation from sexual predation, because so much of this is kind of an allegory for you know, sexual behaviors.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Harker.
Jonathan Harker is who kills him.
Stabbed Dracula through the throat with a kukri knife.
Well, that makes sense too, though. I mean, Harker's the one
It's like a knife with kind of a crooked blade.
Oh, he got him in the throat. Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that does make sense to me, though, because Harker is the initial victim of Dracula.
He's the initial victim of Dracula.
He's the focus of that predatory behavior.
And he's
behavior.
Also Mina's right. husband.
And he's Mina's husband.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he has to be the one to... But also, and a good example of that characteristic kind of predatory female, like the three wives whatever.
And that's kind of where I was going, right? Like, so much of what Dracula is and does is, you know, kind of like covertly sexual. Right.
Yeah.
And so when Jonathan Harker shows up there, he's about to be feasted on by the three brides of Dracula, but it's staged in such a way that the sexual tension is like palpable.
Right? Yeah.
You have these women who are pretty indecent and they're coming on to Jonathan quite hard. And then Dracula shows up and feeds them a baby.
Yeah.
And I think that but this people is have where also, that transgression also... really comes into to the fore, right?
Right?
Because what makes these women so terrifying isn't just their sexual indecency. It's the fact that they also predate on a child in a way that is absolutely contrarian to what we would believe a modern woman should do, right? A good woman would be a wife and mother.
She would not eat the babies.
A good woman would never eat
don't
babies.
Don't eat your babies.
Right. I mean, in
I feel
a
like
patriarchal...
Fat Bastard from Austin Power.
Don't eat the babies.
Get in my belly.
Oh, my God. We need to stop the baby eating.
But remember, this goes back to like some of the vampire myths, like the female vampire myths that predated...
Right, exactly. I think that this is kind of, again...
Predated, I said.
It's looking at these social norms, right? These social expectations. And moralizing, I think, for us, a good woman, right, wouldn't be sexually promiscuous. A good woman would not eat her children. A good woman should be nurturing, and these women are not nurturing.
That's I'm also curious, the- though, too, in that same scene, there's some scholars that point out Dracula's response to the women and say there are homoerotic undertones to it, and I wanted to get your feeling on that. When he says, leave him be, he's mine. And then he gives them the baby.
Oh, sure. But I think, again, like the homoerotic undertones are not necessarily presented as a positive thing. Right,
right.
I think that like quite the contrary, because Dracula is a villain, like at no point in time should we want to emulate Dracula.
Right. Well, there's little Dracula's things too. Head. Like it says like he has hair on the palms. And I think that was believed back in the day to be
thing.
Like a
that's what
like
I
masturbation
was
or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that is so old, isn't it?
Yeah.
Don't touch yourself or you're getting hairy palms.
You'll go blind.
Yeah. And when it's funny is when you tell somebody that and then they immediately look
they
at
go,
their
oh, hands. Shit. Yeah. Yeah. When I was told that in high school, they were talking about, like masturbation being healthy or whatever. And my health teacher was like, you're not going to get hairy palms or something like that. And I was like, don't you dare look at your palms right now. And the kids next to me were like, And she's like, I got you.
A classroom full of kids. They all turn their palms over.
Yeah, of course.
Or like the,
I'd be like, I'm out of here.
Marsha Brady Bunch thing where she's sitting in front of the mirror combing her hair like 99, 100. It's like you just take a brush and hold your hand out and 99, 100.
This is just what I have to do.
It becomes a source of pride. You see, I know what that guy does.
A little bit of Aquanet there on my palm. Style it a little bit. Look, it's a bouffant. It's
another day in the life. That's all it is.
I think it's hilarious how many of these episodes, like, that we just go off on a tangent about masturbation or something.
It's a trick. It's a trick to keep listeners engaged. Every now and then, I'll just whisper
it's a real good thing.
Speaks to our emotional maturity.
It's a real good thing that the Slay Brothers don't listen to us on the regular.
Yeah, you guys didn't notice, but every episode I whisper the word boobs or something like that.
Yeah.
I do it all the time, and that's the only reason people listen to this thing.
You do it what's his face in the Aladdin movie.
Oh, Disney style. Sexual.
You hide the word sex in the background.
I don't know. That just takes me to Dracula Dead and Loving It when the woman's been turned into a vampire and she's trying to get Jonathan Harker. She's like, "Don't you want me, Jonathan?" And he's like, "But I'm British." And she goes, and she holds up her breasts and goes, "So are these."
So are these.
No, but getting back on topic, right?
Hey, I was on topic. I was talking about Dracula.
No,
Dead and
I think
it.
You're right. I think that
that was a great first step to getting
I
back
think
to
that
where we were.
Dracula is described in ways that are both homoerotic and just erotic, right? Yeah. And I think
animalistically
that
sexual.
When he attacks Lucy, it's definitely there's definitely like some weird kinky shit going on.
Oh yeah.
But then Lucy herself, I think, turns into this monster, right? Because Lucy goes out and starts predating on children, and that's the real terror, right? Is that she, this woman who is up until that point, I mean, presented as kind of virginal, kind of Because wasn't she like she's the woman to marry someone?
She was. She had three suitors. She had Dr. Seward. She had Sir Arthur Holmwood, right. And Quincy the Texan.
That's right.
Whose name I don't remember.
That's right. And they were. Like, they were all.
Quincy. I don't remember.
I don't remember. He's the Texan.
Yeah, he's the Texan. Yeah. The Texan. And the fact
that they're all going after her. And they talk about her at great length about like all of her many great qualities. And then
so you get the allusion to this to like Jonathan Swift, by the way, right? Like A Modest Proposal.
Like they eat babies.
Yeah, but in Jonathan Swift was another Irishman who like wrote this whole essay. It was satirical.
Right.
About eating babies, like how to solve their economic problems in Ireland and their overpopulation was to like raise babies and eat them.
Oh man.
And it's funny because Swift, it starts his essay off with like, I was told by this American, and he actually names him like a Texan, like told me this is the right way to do things. And so he's like, has this image.
Don't drag
so
Texas
I think
into
making
this.
The American in this novel like a Texan is a nice little dig like right back to Jonathan Swift. It's like tying this again. It's part of the illusion of illusion, not illusion, folks. I'm gonna
as a Texan, I've got to say there might be some,
how many
there
babies
might be something
have you,
there.
Yeah. You eaten babies?
I mean,
chili started
Texas,
in Texas, and that's where we get that baby.
I never ate a whole baby. No, absolutely not.
The dingo ate my baby.
No.
too much salt.
Yeah,
I don't know. The dingo ate your baby. I think that the patriarchal influence on this book is really, really strong, and I have a hard time like performing any other kind of resistant reading to this book because I think it is so just very clearly didactic in its lessons about how society should operate and the kind of patriarchal influence.
I want to talk a real quick too about, because I think that covers our, do you think that covers our themes pretty well?
I mean, pretty much. This is one of those books that if you go and read real deep and want to dig through some ideas, you're probably going to find something in there.
I think somebody could do a PhD dissertation on this novel.
Absolutely, probably.
I talked earlier in an earlier episode about the idea of primary and secondary themes. And as a writer, I feel like primary themes are the things that I definitely set out that I know my story needs to say. But I think secondary themes are those things that kind of spring out of the narrative as it's being written. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of adjust things. The book that comes to mind for me, did I mention this before? The Harry Cruse, A Feast of Snakes, where I felt like he had started out as he's writing this book, A Feast of Snakes, this reptilian kind of sensibility. But as he's writing the book, I think more of it kind of popped out of the narrative so that he went back and upon revision and included more of this. And I feel like this idea of primary and secondary themes are also representative in Dracula, and that Bram Stoker did the same thing. He set out with a set number of themes, and then like as he developed integrated the historical figure into the monster and then moved into the rest of this, he saw other themes kind of spring forth, and he's like, how can I nurture these and bring these to the surface too?
So I
feel like that, like this only goes to support what you just said, that you could go back on multiple rereadings
and
find something new in the book to talk about.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's kind of a good placeholder for the discussion of theme right now, but it's not the end all be all, and it's not meant to be the end all be all. It's just to give a good introduction. But I think too, I'd like to talk about, and there's so much to talk about with craft. I mean, I could do a whole nother probably 4 or 5 episodes on craft.
There's a lot going on in this book. I mean, it's for the most part an epistolary novel.
It's an epistolary novel where each character has their own unique voice, which is interesting.
That is really interesting and hard to pull off. You do not see a whole lot of different authors who can present a point of view that is truly distinct from other points of view.
Right. And I think we could go on and on and on about this, but let me rein it in just real quickly and talk like what I've been talking about the entire season, which was the objective correlative. And I feel like this novel is a masterclass in studying the objective correlative, that idea of the outside mirroring the inside. Mm. You know, we talked about the movement from east to west, from mysticism to science, and we have the outside, you know, representing this from, say, Romania and the haunted, you know, environment and the cultures and the setting.
Quite ancient, right?
Very ancient.
So the objective, I was Googling this because I don't know about this stuff like you guys do.
Yeah.
Objective correlative, to my understanding, is when you use symbols to represent some kind of emotional response, right?
Right.
Yeah. So symbols, what all does that encompass? Does that encompass
everything?
The setting?
People want to link to historically. People just limit it to they limit it to like, oh, it was a dark and stormy night kind of deal. Like they want to limit it to the setting.
Comparison.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
But it can encompass anything. It can be, you know, your character could be walking outside and comment on, you know, the sunny kind of cloudless day. They could be, you know, music or a song could play in the background that would reflect on that. It could be the way he depicts, like the haunted, if you read the passages where Harker is traveling into Transylvania to go meet Dracula, the imagery is very haunting, very disturbing.
Right.
And it really unsettles Harker.
Representative of, it unsettles Harker. Harker feels very unsettled, but it also works to describe like kind of the moment of history. Yeah. Right, because he walks into this place that feels haunted, and really I think that haunting is reflecting back on us like this long and storied period of violence that we have not seen, that Harker is then feeling uneasy about as he walks into this space.
And as he investigates and as he learns about it, I mean, it's more reflecting his interior emotion.
I think for another example would be like you know, Dracula, he spots Dracula just like fucking crawling around the side of this building like an animal, like a lizard, which I think is, again, intended to kind of demonstrate to us like Dracula is not a human being. He's something entirely different.
Right.
We can't treat him with the same kind of respect that we might give to an actual human being, because this dude is a literal monster.
So you don't know what to expect from him.
But I think I think it's not going deep enough if we discuss the objective correlative merely with the presence of the characters on the page. I think those emotions are meant to also reflect in us as the reader. They're meant to reflect in the character of the setting, because to me, London and Transylvania, Romania, Castle Dracula, Carfax Abbey, these are very much characters in the novel themselves. And so that idea that the outside or that symbols represent the emotional states of the interior of the characters or whatever can also reflect on the bigger part of the narrative, or even reflect on us as readers too.
Yeah, right. I mean, how much of it is about our attitudes toward these various places? I mean, you think about something like Romania, and I mean, what so much of our perception of what realistically is modernized country, right, is still that it's very poor and it's backwards and backwoods. You know, you see Borat and Borat's depiction of like of Georgia
with Romania. When it comes to Romania, I've always pictured like people that are cold eating like beet
like
soup,
you know,
like borscht.
Yeah,
that's
kind of
Russian, I think, but
I think that there's a misconception there, right? Because Romanians have the internet, you know.
But I want to reiterate this point I made, I think, back in the second part of the Bram Stoker story, is that now I'm not going to say that no Romanian had ever read or heard of Dracula. I'm just saying that Dracula, the novel, was not published in Romanian at large until 1990.
Right.
So their perception of the historical figure was not colored by pop culture and by Bram Stoker's interpretation.
That's just amazing to me that it took that long for them to...
It's wild. I mean,
read that.
But I think these things, you know, as they're presented to us, reflect our perception of these places too, right? Yeah. I mean, how much of our like Transylvania, this like spooky, creepy place that never modernized, is due to figures like Bram Stoker, who are like, you know, every place in the East is mystical, right? Because we're given so much in our pop culture that suggests that the East is just so wildly different from the West.
Yeah.
And I think in the 20th century, at least for many of us, it is not that different.
No.
Damn you, globalization. You took away the...
Yeah.
I'm more of a musician, so I have to bring up the Beatles. You know, they went to... India, and they got into the culture, and then they started putting sitars in their music, and you know they did that for a reason, and it was to kind of show that there's a lot of use, there's a lot of accessibility in that culture for anybody.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's always like, as an American, our notions of these places are kind of just,
it's so skewed.
Laughable. Sometimes.
It's so skewed.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks that. Mexico is just orange all the time because we never film anything in Mexico without a sepia tone on it.
Yeah.
So when they go and it's like bright blue skies.
The last time
like,
I went down to Mexico, as soon as I crossed the border, I had a sepia tone on me, and I was
exactly. Yeah,
and then Quentin Tarantino is like standing there at the bar, like talking shit.
Here at Dr. Seward's Mental Emporium, we specialize in treating all manner of disorders and behaviors using a plethora of modern techniques. If you have a loved one who is suffering, please don't hesitate to call us. We have a state-of-the-art behavioral calaboose where every resident will receive their own private, secure quarters. Our quad has the appropriate furnishings to secure any patient's needs, from straitjackets to chains to minimalist bedding to ensure that no harm can come to those in treatment. We treat multiple personalities, psychosis, depression, adultery,
wife only,
homosexuality, animal cruelty, alcoholism, drug addiction, hysteria in women,
but not spousal abuse or pedophilia,
using such treatments as full lobotomies, electroshock therapy, ice baths, manacling to isolated settings like outhouses, beds, or posts, and a wide variety of colonics. We incorporate medicines like laudanum and other opiates and cocaine to treat our patients. So if you or anyone you know is a lunatic, imbecile, or idiot, don't just settle for any asylum. Come to Dr. Seward's Mental Emporium today.
Always a vacancy, overcrowding not an issue, acceptance into the program does not guarantee a length of stay, as you will likely never leave. So let's revisit my thesis really quickly. Stoker, on his own, wasn't as influential an author as maybe some of his contemporaries. I'll add that little bit in there too. And his body of work as a whole did not impact the literary zeitgeist to a large degree. But due to the novel's lasting power, that's one thing, Stoker's ability to include primary and secondary themes reflecting society and the individual, which help elevate the genre novel to literary status, and the novel's influence on pop culture and genre fiction, Dracula is one of the most influential English language novels of all time.
I feel like I can agree with this thesis as you've revised it.
Yeah.
I think that we've hit kind of the right nuance here, and I think this reflects on some of the reason why we wanted to have this conversation in the first place.
Yeah.
Because a lot of horror, a lot of genre, you know, does lean back on some of the stuff that Stoker was doing. And I think he is a great representation of what genre can do, is capable of doing
exactly
for human storytelling.
And that's the thing. That's what kind of spurned this discussion between Trevor and I initially. Way before we even started the podcast, what gave us the idea of doing a podcast was like, hey, we want to show, put out into the world so that it could be proven to academia that genre has a valuable place in this discussion.
Well, and I think also just reaching out to people who maybe are reluctant readers or maybe have never explored this stuff before and try to encourage them to encounter more of this stuff in the stuff that they read, you know, the literary diet that they have.
I'm one of those people.
Yeah. But I think that Dracula, what's great about Dracula is it does set us up for kind of like a, I don't know, like a long tradition, a century long tradition at this point for vampires and vampire fiction and what vampire fiction is capable of doing. And we see a couple of other figures crop up throughout the 20th century that I think would at least innovate a little bit on what Stoker was doing and present kind of minor paradigm shifts going forward.
Right. But before we discuss those figures, let's really quickly recap how to define those paradigm shifts through Dracula, through the novel, right?
Sure.
So one, we have Dr. Seward and Abraham Van Helsing suggesting that whatever this transmission is happening, whatever is turning people into vampires, occurs through the blood, through the exchange of blood, right? That's one thing. Two,
yeah,
we have the...
I think it's... I would categorize... I mean, that is, but I would categorize that just like in a broader category,
yeah.
I think, is the conflict between... mysticism
science and mysticism.
Right. Which right. are like is a mainstay for so much of horror. You know, I try to watch a horror movie nowadays that doesn't try at least to counter, you know, the mysticism with science.
Right.
It's almost impossible.
It really is. The second thing is the sexualization of the predator in this novel,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
The sexualization of vampires. And then finally, and this is where I want to add my and twos into this, like we've discussed off podcast, but I really think this fits, is this idea of trying to elevate the genre to higher art and present a more cohesive, more intellectual narrative.
Yeah.
Along with
I this. Do have to state, I don't necessarily believe that Stoker was trying to elevate genre to horror.
I don't think so. I just think he was using his craft as best
he
could.
I don't think that genre existed in the 19th century as it exists now. Genre, when we talk about it in the 20th century or the 21st century, I think is really relegated to marketing. I mean, so much of what we consider about genre is just a marketing ploy. Prior to that marketing ploy, where we start grouping like things together in order to foster a readership, you know, foster people who are going to buy books.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, these are all just pieces of literature. And
I
think
there were so many
Stoker's
of those contemporary authors
literature.
Who were writing, you know, what would be considered nowadays genre fiction.
We talked about Edith Wharton.
I mean,
who wrote almost like a ton of ghost fiction. She was practically the queen of ghost fiction.
J. Sheridan Le Fanu, we mentioned him.
Yeah.
We mentioned, I mean, there's a ton of them back then.
Who is the gal who did Little Women?
Oh, I don't remember what her name is, but I know who you're talking about.
Man, we gotta record with all of my tangents, like, out in front of me.
If you're gonna bring something up, man, you gotta
you gotta know what you're talking
your
about.
I got it.
But Louisa May Alcott. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, she wrote a whole bunch of crime fiction, like bloody, violent crime fiction, before she went on to make Little Women and become popular for that.
I think that's a rear view mirror kind of perceptive view of like saying Stoker wrote, you know, with elevating the literature or whatever. He didn't write to say that. That means he imbued or included craft choices that are educated choices. He wasn't just out to tell story using here's story A, here's story B. Point B, here's point C.
And
I'm in.
I think my contention there is just
it's not pulp. It's not like it's not.
But pulp would come after him, right? And that's what I'm trying to say is I don't think.
Well, there were penny dreadfuls around his time, and penny dreadfuls could be included as pulp.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, he's been lumped in with a lot of the penny dreadfuls.
And
in the
United States, they had the dime novel, which had the little westerns and stuff and adventure stories were
absolutely.
These were novels. I mean, these were stories that, you know, Stoker spent 6 years putting this novel together.
Yeah.
There's some artists who create their what is considered literature, air quote that, who spent a couple of years writing this thing, as opposed to the writer who, like, you know, types it out in 6 months and gets it off to the publisher, and all the characters are stock and all the characters are flat and they have no dimension to them whatsoever. You know, I'll name drop somebody, James Patterson. James Patterson is if we were
100 years after Bram Stoker, but
he's 100 years after, but he's a good example of that.
No,
he's
I
a
think
good
you're
example
right.
of and I he's think, not imbuing any kind of real craft into his stories. He's just pushing
and I think
this
those,
shit out.
Those writers did exist in Stoker's
oh,
time.
Oh, they did.
I mean,
yeah.
George Reynolds with the Mysteries of London, like the where we get the idea of the Penny Dreadful from.
Yeah.
He was one of the most popular writers in Britain. He was more popular than Charles Dickens at one point in time. And Dickens hated him, you know, because like that was very much like George Reynolds was the trash literature of his time.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I think what I'm saying is that I don't know that Stoker came out necessarily to elevate anything or to provide a piece of literature that was, you know, in contrast with something he felt.
I don't
was
think
low
he
art.
Did either.
You think it's all just
but
kind
I also
of a retrospective?
Think, I know where you're leaning though, and what you're leaning on is basically to say that in literature after this fiction, right, after Bram Stoker, we see a lot of people take ideas from Bram Stoker and start to turn it real pulpy. And then we have writers later on who go back to that pulp and try to re-implement some of that literary merit.
But what I'm saying pulpiness. With Stoker is that Stoker, because there were these pulpy kind of contemporaries, there were these less crafted as far as, I mean, they're still written stories, but they're not as well crafted stories. Sure. They don't take as much time. Stoker didn't do that. He didn't rest on his laurels in writing this story. He not only did years of research, he also spent a lot of time developing the different voices. He incorporated into the storytelling craft decisions, which takes more time. And in doing this, that elevated the story to a more literary platform, as opposed to somebody who punches out a story in 6 months and the characters are flat. There's no real decisions. There's no real any kind of input into this. It's like, here's my story. Here it is. He didn't do that. So no, I don't think he set out to write something. This isn't something he consciously said, this is how I'm going to do it. Just like I don't set out to write, like, am I going to write this pulpy or am I going to write it, you know, really good? He took the craft that he had already learned and what he already knew and, you know, and used that to create this story. Just as I do, just as some of our better authors do when we've talked about, you know, we didn't just sit down and be like, you know, we're not these people on Twitter
it's
that are like
a product, right? He's not just.
I didn't. I wrote 5,000 words today. It's like, yeah, but are they great words? I mean, probably not. I mean,
I don't know. I'm not gonna go out and say that any of those people who hit their word targets or whatever are not. Cranking out good
but
stuff.
If that's where you're starting, if you're starting from a place of quantity,
I feel like we could, this is a conversation I want to have, but I want to hold this conversation for when we talk about R.L. Stine in the next season.
There you
okay.
go.
Because I have some very contentious views about those who write for quantity versus those who would quote unquote write for quality. And I feel like the people who are writing for quantity are still writing quality, but it's different. And I want to talk about what the differences are there.
I
want to go on the record of defense for the people who are like, I write 5,000 words a day. I'm like, I think that there's still something of great literary merit going on there. And I do want to just put a pin in that discussion for later.
Well, and I will always say, because I tend to start off from like from my own, you know, my own ability to storytell and my own viewpoints on this podcast, I tend to start with something very broad and then I funnel it into something a little more nuanced.
Yeah.
And that's just how I've always written. That's how I've always done things. So I'm not going to fully disagree with you.
Yeah.
But I am going to say, you know, with my broad, not yet nuanced viewpoint on this, I do think just, I agree with Curtis, you know, it's just quantity, but I will redefine and make that more nuanced when we have that discussion for R.L. Stine.
This is how a lot of our conversations go.
They actually usually. Do. Yeah.
I feel like they do go this way.
Yeah.
But to your point, right, and I think that what you're trying to set up is talking about later writers who would revisit these genre elements and try to remove them from the quote unquote cultural gutter and elevate them.
Right. So what we want to look at really, I think, are probably three writers that took each of these areas and really kind of moved them or kind of created their own minor paradigm shifts with them. Two of them did more to make a paradigm shift than the third, but the third is kind of he in of himself is kind of the antithesis of Stoker, who his body of work didn't matter a lot. This third author that we're going to talk about in this group is he's more prolific in his work.
Oh,
is.
Yeah, definitely.
So the first author we're going to mention is Richard Matheson.
Yeah.
When did you say that book was published?
I can't remember. It was in the 50s.
I Am Legend.
I Am Legend.
Or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. I can't remember. We should have written that in our show notes.
I should have, yeah.
FYI, this is just
going off my memory.
This is the episode where we all just sit around and never get anything right.
The entire episode is like us lazy. Just on our phones.
This is all very last minute. Yeah. FYI, I Am Legend was not a movie first. That was actually
a book from like, I think, 54.
It was 54. It was 1954.
And Richard Matheson really kind of brought back this idea of the vampire as something transmissible through disease, through a virus.
Which is cool. That's pretty cool.
There's a lot that the story does, that I Am Legend, that I think is really interesting in and of its own right. I think that none of the movies that have been produced about I Am Legend, not the Will Smith one, not the Omega Man, not any of the others, that have been produced even come close to like the idea that Matheson was really playing with. But one of the concepts, one of the conceits that Matheson puts in this story is that vampirism is transmissible like a virus.
Right.
Right? Yeah. It's some kind of like viral or bacterial agent which transforms the person, you know, as the host to whatever this disease is. And that is has become a hallmark, right, of so much fiction going forward. Yeah. The idea of whatever this is being transmissible specifically through a viral agent. The Walking Dead. I mean, you can't have a zombie movie without
28
Richard Matheson's.
Later.
Yeah, without Richard Matheson's influence.
And I'm kind of tired of this idea, guys. I don't know. What do you guys think? Curtis, you said you liked it.
I liked it. You know, I'm the only one in this room right now that hasn't read the novel I Am Legend.
I don't think I've read I Am Legend yet. I don't believe I've read it yet.
I did read it. And it's good. It's also not what I was expecting going in.
See our Richard Matheson episode, folks.
I've only seen the Will Smith movie, but what I'm guessing is not different is the fact that the main character is virtually completely alone in this, right?
Right.
More or less,
I mean, it's like him and everybody else has turned.
Everybody else is gone.
The movie made me feel like this crushing loneliness. I mean, just absolutely soul-destroying loneliness that this guy has.
Yeah.
The images of him walking through the city and there's just nobody. Everything's overrun with vines. There are deer on the sidewalk. It's just amazing. I'm guessing that's not different from the novel, you know.
You're wrong.
Am I wrong?
I'll tell you what the novel is.
Let's do it.
The main character, Neville or whatever his name is. Mm-hmm. I think Neville is his last name.
In the movie, it was probably Will, because I don't think Will Smith can act with any other character named Will.
No, I think it's like Robert Neville or Richard Neville
like,
or something like that.
That sounds right.
Neville. And Will's just looking off somewhere and somebody's like, Will. And he's like, oh, yeah.
Sorry, I'm really bad at this.
I can't remember what Will Smith's character is. It's been a minute.
Yeah.
But so essentially, he is the last man, or he believes himself to be the last man, right, in his neighborhood or whatever. He's kind of in this suburban area, though, and he rolls out a couple times a day to, like, you know, do whatever it is that he does. And he does, like, kill some of his neighbors. He does, like, try to eradicate some of these, like, vampire whatever he's running into. But they can talk. They know who he is. They show up outside of his house all the time, and they talk shit at him and stuff like that.
So they're not like completely, you know, like dead-eyed.
No, they can't be out during the daytime, but at nighttime they do come and antagonize him, right? And so eventually he, you know, because he's going out and slaughtering them the whole time as they're evolving through whatever their illness is. And
he
like teaches himself biochemistry to kind of understand who they are and you know, figures out that it's like this viral agent or whatever. And he's the only one who knows this. Eventually he's captured by these vampires. They hold this like new court, right? The court of their new society or whatever, as they continue to evolve, because he's the last human and they've all turned into whatever it is. And so they decide to publicly execute him.
Holy shit. I'm so backwardsly wrong about that.
They decide to execute him as like the last human because he's killed so many of them. And he realizes that as he was worrying about them as vampires or whatever, as these creatures from myth or from legend, he's the legend because they all remember him as the only remaining like not new human or new vampire or whatever it is
whatever
that they,
it is
are.
They are.
He's the only one who is never turned, and he killed so many of them that now he's become legend. And that's where we get the title.
So why couldn't that have been the movie?
Dude,
that
I have no clue.
That sounds incredible.
I have no clue. I went in to, I saw Omega Man. I saw this movie. And both of them are very weird. The Will Smith I Am Legend is just weird.
It is weird.
And I did not necessarily like either one of them. I was like, I don't understand what they're doing here. The Omega Man is real. You got to watch that with Charlton Heston. It's real weird. It has a completely different subtext than like the Will Smith one does even. And I didn't care much for the Will Smith one because I was like, I don't know. This doesn't feel like it's all that special. And then I went to read the book, and I was very reluctant to read the book because I didn't like either of those two movies. And then the book's so completely different. I was like, holy fuck, this is way better than either of the movies.
It's so frustrating that they never just take what's in the book and just really try and pull it off.
Yeah.
I think they could. Really frustrating. I feel like they could. I feel like we could get a new director who could really take this story and bring it back to the book. And I know you and I have had that discussion before about how like, you know, adaptions are good because they, you know, we get the original and so adaptions are fine. You know, I was like, you know, I want to see a true to the book, you know, kind of story being played out in another media before I get these adaptions and stuff. I think what's come after that in this, down this Matheson path has just exhausted me. Like you and I have both read Guillermo del Toro's The Strain,
which was co-written by Chuck Hogan.
Yeah. That is an exhausting trilogy.
Oh my gosh. I couldn't even make my way through it.
They spend so much time like, you know, answering why these things can exist and mansplaining to you what
I just I lost interest the moment when Chuck Hogan started like explaining to me diagram of how an airplane fucking works.
Yeah.
Like there's a whole part in the first book where Chuck Hogan is just like, he's just explaining to you where the parts of an airplane are because they're trying to crack into this airplane that's full of like a biological agent.
I think the one that pissed me off though, because we also had like Daybreakers, you've got like, you know, all these.
Which is good. Daybreakers is a good movie.
Yeah, but it's on that same, it's like Underworld. It's like I mean, it turns them into this like an urban fantasy kind of thing instead of horror. But the one that pissed me off, and we're mentioning some pretty high, well-respected authors in this discussion here. The one that pissed me off was Dan Simmons, Summer of Night, where he spends, it's a 400-page book about vampires, and he spends the first 150 pages telling you how a vampire could physically, like medically and scientifically be real. And I'm like, I don't give a shit. Just give me the vampires.
He probably, you know, thinks that there's a lot of people out there that are gonna really appreciate all of that. Like,
I don't
you know,
need it.
Like,
I don't need it. Well, when I pick up a book about vampires or I watch a movie about it, I don't need it.
They're not real.
I'm gonna push on you for a moment. I think Dan Simmons, like the reason that book exists the way it does is because Dan Simmons is one of those writers who's like, I'm going to elevate this genre right here. You watch me elevate this genre.
Well, and I think he actually went to Transylvania. I think he went to Romania.
She's like trying to bring logic to the table and like, we're going to make all of this make sense.
That's a very Dan Simmons
thing.
I don't need it to make sense.
Right. Dan Simmons is a very high concept writer, I think.
I didn't pick up this book to explain to me how my neighbor is acting weird. I don't fucking need this as a manual. I want to read about vampires.
Yeah. Get on with it. Yeah.
But no, if the antibodies are formed through this cell and then come to this organ.
I can agree with you. And this is one of the things that frustrates me is because this trope has become so influential in all of horror fiction. Like when we saw Antlers.
Yeah.
And I remember we had that conversation where I was like, I'm kind of bothered by the fact that this curse is passed on to this guy through a bite, right? And like we show he's bitten, and then all of a sudden,
spoiler alert.
Yeah, all of a sudden you turn into a Wendigo, or the threat is that you're gonna turn into a Wendigo because you were bitten by a Wendigo. I think that's so fucking dumb. I really do.
It's always a bite, right?
Yeah, it's always a bite. And there's no innovation there. And I'm like, you know what? I get the parallel because they're trying to say that the Wendigo, the curse of the Wendigo in this case, is like it like manifests as trauma, and it manifests as like a cycle of violence.
Yeah, but I think that's the actual myth too. I think if you're bitten by the Wendigo, given the nature of like the cannibalism, it was a myth on cannibalism.
Well, I know, but I thought it was a curse. I always understood it as, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's someone out there who's like into indigenous studies or Native American studies who can correct me.
Stephen Graham Jones, get back with us and let us know.
Somebody who's more knowledgeable than me,
but
maybe.
Not Stephen Jones, the
but
editor.
But I always understood it as it's not Stephen Jones, the white guy in Britain. I always understood it as like it's a curse, right? You turn into a Wendigo, not because you're bitten by a Wendigo, but because you transgress against the laws of nature, and therefore you start transforming. So you don't have to be bitten by a Wendigo.
Like Trevor's dog bit me the other day. I didn't turn into a dog.
Thank God. This would be a weird podcast.
I might smell like a dog.
Yeah. No, but coming back to this trope, I am tired of it. I'm very tired of this trope. I'm ready for us to just be, you know, go back to embrace, like, I don't know.
I think there could have been a better balance. I don't think we had to, you know, I didn't need for Summer of Night like 150 pages explaining me the scientific possibility of a vampire.
Right.
You know, but that's another thing. I mean, that's what Stoker did so well, is he balanced that medical and the mystical. And that's what we need more of, I think. I think we need to get back to that.
I just want to get back to the mystical stuff.
I want to get back to the mystical stuff too. And that brings up our second author, who did a little slight paradigm shift, and we were in a. I'm going to speak out again because we mentioned her a few episodes ago. It's now been a few weeks, but she was one of the first deaths of 2022. Anne Rice was very influential on vampires.
She heightened and highlighted
that that idea of the sexual and the romantic monster.
Yeah, I think that. When you look at urban fantasy today, and especially like the impulses of urban fantasy, I think that's all Anne Rice.
Yeah.
I think it comes from the stories that she wrote, starting with Interview with a Vampire and continuing from there. She put a real emphasis on the sexuality of these vampires.
Mm-hmm.
But she also told stories that were, you know, deep with drama and conflict and, you know, sometimes that was like generational, because you have these creatures that are here forever. She also gave us some real interesting bits of horror and innovations on horror, like the child vampire, the child immortal.
Yeah.
Which was an Anne Rice thing and a terrifying thing.
Yeah.
So I think that we owe a lot more in terms of cultural mainstay with vampire fiction to Anne Rice.
So the third, and I agree with Trevor in this, Trevor's idea was that the paradigm shifts occurred greater with Richard Matheson and Anne Rice, but I still think Stephen King had an influence on this, and that before I think Salem's Lot was in between these two previous novels. It was in between, I think it came before Interview with a Vampire, but way.
No, it came after Interview with a Vampire. You're right. It was like 74 and she was like 76 or something.
Yeah, something like that. So it was a lot closer to the Interview with a Vampire than it was Richard Matheson's Legend.
Yeah.
But it represents that third part of the trifecta, whereas the vampire is scary. And I'm sorry, but to me, just as iconic as any of these other things, the boy flying and hovering outside the window, like knocking on the window pane saying, let me in, that terrified me from like the first time I saw it in the old TV movie from like 1978. And I think that was really well done. But I think he kept the idea the vampire is scary. So they stay away from the vampires that come from this line of thought, I don't think can be really, I mean, there is some horror in Interview with a Vampire, but they're still humanized.
I think they're scarier than you think. No, you're right. They should just make them a kind of humanish character, or well, human character. They have human problems.
Yeah.
Right. Just because they're immortal, I think their problems just shift to, you know, in a speculative way, you know, the problems of a person who can live for forever.
And Stephen King is kind of reminding us that these things are fucking creepy. They're monsters. They're predators. They're meant to terrify us. And he shows over the course of this novel how that was his whole premise too, was that he wanted Dracula. He said Dracula wouldn't come to a big city like London. He wouldn't come to New York City. He said, I think Dracula would come to small town America, and that's how he would gain
Forks, Washington.
Stephen King is really good about doing that, right?
I know that was a Twilight. I'm ignoring your Twilight joke.
Because that kind of implies like Dracula could live in your town, right?
Right.
That makes it scarier. It's just like Pennywise.
And he also looks at themes. He looks at some interesting themes like that, because he in Salem's Lot, he talks about, you know, the idea of small evil versus large world evil, and small evil is just as predatory, like the small town, the banal kind of evil is just
it's also a continuation of what a lot of horror was doing in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah,
you know, we've talked before briefly about William Peter Blatty with like The Exorcist. I think he's kind of like the perfect example of the domestic horror. You know, the kind of small town horror.
Yeah.
But I think that Blatty even is just a continuation of a long kind of series of efforts to try to relocalize horror.
Right.
To give it back to us in our homes.
Well, and that, you know, that to me, that kind of pushes against, like, say, one of the original progenitors of horror in the United States, which was like Edgar Allan Poe, who set a lot of his stories in like these unnamed, far off kind of lands.
Yeah.
And that goes back to this idea of horror and genre all the way back to like romance literature. And I don't mean romance like Jane Austen or Harlequin or anything like that, but I mean like the romantic era. You know, knights and the idea of like them going off to fight supernatural creatures in far off lands. The idealization of it. Yeah. Right. And Stephen King and William Peter Blatty very consciously say, no, horror can exist in your little pocket of the world and can be just as monumental as it is way out there.
Yeah. Right.
And even scarier. Horror can exist in your marriage just as much as it can exist, you know, external to it.
Right,
It's just as present in the corrupt businessman as it is in the evil preacher, or as it is in the warrior general who is slaughtering thousands in genocide.
There's very little difference. The scaling is just different.
The scaling is different. And
I think he brings it to a domestic space, which is a lot of the influence. I think, you know, what we're talking about here is like seeing, that domestic space, you know, become more and more a space for horror.
Yeah.
And The Lost Boys, I think, was one of those texts that we had talked about.
I just watched The Lost Boys again the other night.
Yeah. The Lost Boys, it's a good movie. I wouldn't say that it necessarily elevates the genre.
I didn't say it elevated genre. I just said I love the movie.
Yeah. But I think it's in the same vein of Stephen King, right? It kind of puts
what did you do to me,
vampires in our lives, and it kind of gives.
Thou shall not kill.
Are you just gonna reenact the whole movie?
I'm just gonna reenact the whole fucking movie. Yeah. I love it. Scene one. The camera swoops down from the sky view of the carnival.
No, but I think, to your credit, I mean, like Lost Boys, I think is centered in kind of like modern domestic life.
Just saying, put the Lost Boys up against the fucking Cullens, and we'll see who comes out on top. I mean,
I don't know. Have you seen them play baseball? Because the Cullens can play baseball.
Have you seen Kiefer Sutherland rip a biker's head off in that movie while his face changes? He rips a fucking biker's head off.
The most 80s vampire of all time, right?
Yeah. I don't know. And then Fright Night. I loved Fright Night. Like, that was...
Sure. another kind of like kooky. I see a lot of this is like also a reinterpretation of, you know, like pop culture itself, yeah. right? Like a very knowing pop culture meta representation.
Well, and that's the last thing I think we ought to talk about is this idea of like the vampires and Dracula's influence on pop culture. And I think we can just kind of go off from there and do that.
From the makers of Dr. Seward's Laudanum comes Dr. Seward's Cocaine.
Mommy, I scraped my knee.
Here, have some cocaine.
I just don't feel like cleaning the house today.
Here, have some cocaine.
My sinuses are really blocked. Oh, the pressure.
You need some cocaine.
That's right, folks. Dr. Seward has a cure for whatever ails you. And now, get your cocaine today.
Soon available in a delightful carbonated beverage or powdered form. You said your first impression was, your first exposure to vampires was Interview with a Vampire. Mine was like Fright Night.
I never saw Fright Night.
Oh, man, Fright Night. So Fright Night had Roddy McDowell from like the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
And he was a late night television host on these bad like Hammer style kind of like old vampire and horror movies. And this kid who actually real life is from South Arkansas and he went to school with my uncle. Like my uncle knows him, named William Ragsdale. Is the star of Fright Night, and it had Amanda Bierce, who was later on like a Married with Children. She was the neighbor. He thinks his neighbor next door is a vampire, and he gets Roddy McDowell. He goes to visit him, who ends up being just the biggest coward in the world. Like he presents himself as like this famed vampire hunter, and he's like, "I am a great vampire hunter," and all this, and then he's like, he finds the vampire, and he's like, "Oh, he's like running out
shit,
of there,
a scared. Vampire!" Yeah.
and it's real campy, like it's real campy, but it has some good horror moments and some great practical effects in it. And so that was my first exposure. Was like, "Ooh, vampires are supposed to be scary,"
right?
And then I watched the Salem's Lot, like the Tobe Hooper Salem's Lot, and then I watched Lost Boys.
Yeah.
And so I'm like going into this with like, ooh, scary vampires. So when I picked up Interview with a Vampire, I'm like, what the fuck is this?
It felt like one of those novels that your grandma keeps in her bedside table, right?
No, a little bit.
Like,
kind of
a Fabio type thing.
Yeah, it kind of does.
Well, and Brad Pitt kind of was Fabio at the time,
right?
Yeah,
with that hair, he was still Fabio.
He kind of still is. It's a bit ridiculous.
But then we got Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Totally different kind of
movie. The only piece of media out there that has a longer name than Slay House Publishing.
Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula.
That's what inspired me to title our podcast was
Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah, so, and you get Keanu Reeves with his on again, off again British accent.
Whoa.
Vampires.
I am.
So, my first exposure to vampire fiction and really Dracula was the old 1930s movie.
With
Bela Lugosi.
Again, though, he's still supposed to be scary there.
What movie?
He's supposed to be.
Yeah.
The MGM Studios is Bela Dracula Lugosi. With Bela Lugosi.
Okay, no, I thought you were talking about Nosferatu, but that's earlier,
that
right? Well,
that was earlier, yeah. And yeah. I did eventually see Nosferatu
but
as
those
a teenager.
Only for me, those only reinforce, like, the vampire is scary, right?
I mean, in a way, yeah.
Yeah, Nosferatu's
but also
the scariest
a little campy, because,
you know,
the 1930s movies definitely get into... I mean, Dracula meets Abbott and Costello at one point in time.
Yeah.
Which I think is really goofy.
That was like one of the first shared universes, though.
It's actually a lot of fun,
fun. Which of these iterations of Dracula did Christopher Lee star as Dracula?
So that was in the 70s.
That was like the Hammer film stuff.
We haven't even talked
stuff.
About the fact that Christopher Lee played Dracula like 50 times, right?
That was like an extension of the Universal Monsters, right?
Yeah, him
like,
and Frank Langella. Both played Dracula for a long time.
I mean,
and you
like
also got Dark Shadows in there, like the old Dark Shadows.
Dark Shadows there was a vampire in Dark Shadows, but that was a soap opera
right.
that like became crazy
Like my parents would tell me about running home from school just to watch it.
Dark Shadows. Yeah. That was that Johnny Depp movie too, right?
They did a remake.
And I liked it.
Yeah.
I loved the secret compartments of the house. Yeah, like the house is just like, it never ends.
But if you watch, I mean, there are hundreds of episodes of Dark Shadows because it was a daily show. It was a daily soap opera.
Yeah.
And it originally was not a vampire story. It was like originally just a gothic kind of, almost like a gothic romance, a gothic drama.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they introduced several hundred episodes in, they introduced a vampire character.
Do you think that's kind of what
maybe dominate the show?
The Addams Family, do you think that's maybe what they were referencing a little bit?
Oh, I wouldn't doubt it.
Because the Addams Family is not about vampires or any specific monster. It's just like a gothic family.
As we'll talk about with the Addams Family, the Addams Family was actually, I think, a cartoon series.
Don't spoil season two. Don't tell them.
No, but no, the Addams Family was originally
steeped in gothic sensibilities.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
And the Munsters. I mean, the Munsters
was the same.
Like, Grandpapa is Dracula. I mean,
yes.
I thought that was brilliant show. The old Munsters.
Yeah, the old Munsters.
Yeah. I grew up watching. My parents didn't necessarily let me watch the Addams Family a whole lot, but I watched a lot of the Munsters, and I watched all of Bela Lugosi's Dracula stuff. I eventually did, like I said, I saw Nosferatu later. I saw, in grad school, I saw the remake of Nosferatu by Werner Herzog.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Was it scary? Yes. Very scary?
That one, I mean, not very scary, but it is scary.
It is scary.
Okay. Yeah, it is a good one.
And I like the one done by, who wrote it or who directed it? It's got, it's called Shadow of the Vampire, where Willem Dafoe plays the Shrek or whatever the guy's name, Max Shrek, who plays Nosferatu. And the idea was that Max Shrek was actually a real vampire that they cast to play the vampire. So when you see him vanish at the end of the film, that's really them killing him. And it had John Malkovich and Cary Elwes and like all these other actors in it. And John Malkovich was F.W. Murnau. And
Cary, he did more movies than Princess Bride.
We recently saw him in Black Christmas.
Yeah,
the remake of Black Christmas.
Oh my god! You know, I saw him in that movie Saw, and I was like, "Holy shit! There he is!" After all these years.
Right. He's done lots of stuff.
I didn't know he was doing other stuff.
He was. Have you ever seen?
I love the guy.
He was in a Hot Shots.
That guy.
He was. He was the Val Kilmer character in Hot Shots.
Yeah. Oh my god!
So
excellent.
So yeah. So I mean, yeah. My favorite, though, has to be the Simpsons Halloween Treehouse of Horror special.
Oh, they draw so heavily on it.
Don't their Halloween specials just always deliver?
They do.
And every single time.
Like, they spoof the Francis Ford Coppola Dracula.
Which I
think
is
like, Homer's, like, taking him to dinner, and he's like, we're going to dinner at my boss's house in Pennsylvania.
I think that Francis Ford Coppola's movie is one of the best representations of Dracula.
The Coppolanian interpretation.
I think that movie is incredibly good.
Coppola is so good anyway speaking of the objective correlative, his setting, his cinematography is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. His costumes.
And he did a good job of bringing in and reminding us that Dracula is that historical figure because his name is made to look like the historical figure with the long hair and the mustache. And,
the intro to that movie even places him as the great warlord with that like weird muscle
that
suit
weird,
going on.
Yeah, that red muscle
Can we talk
armor?
About that? What was that?
I don't know, but I'm here for it.
Dude,
I mean,
I thought it was
cool.
Great. I know. I think it's just like it looked like the like a flayed human being.
I was gonna
right?
say it, to me, it was like, whoa, this guy is so obsessed with peeling people's skin off. He wants to like.
I mean,
he
that,
wants to look like
it,
muscle tissue.
But I
like,
think it's also for one, it's very sensuous. You know, like the
sinuous.
Idea of.
Sinuous
in a way. No, but I think it's
we play with
like,
words
because
on the podcast.
It's very sculpted, right?
Yeah.
But also it's intimidating because you know Dracula was an intimidating
Who
dude.
Who the hell else dresses like that? Yeah, it makes him look like.
Yeah, exactly. He's like,
I don't know, guys. I re-listened to our episode. He wasn't that intimidating.
No, really.
It's like NC-17. Like we have explicit episodes, and then we have an episode that's rated NC-17. I think that's definitely our NC-17 episode.
Yeah, just brace yourself and See what you get.
But I think that, you know. I think that Dracula is just so influential in a lot of, like, cultural adaptation. You know, we see all of these innovations or these, like trying to renovate an old house. They represent to us, you know, Dracula in a new light. And it's always so very interesting because you can't necessarily divorce all of our cultural knowledge of Dracula from the new stuff that comes out that is Dracula, because it's all so interconnected. Right. You know, when you talk about something like Fright Night, or you talk about something like The Lost Boys, right? In
or
some way,
like
shape, or form.
30 Days of Night.
Yeah, like they lean back so heavily on what we already know either about vampires or about Dracula as a figure.
Yeah.
And they continue to, I think, just kind of like multiply into these many different representations. Whether we get a Dracula who looks just like Bela Lugosi, or who looks like the more traditional Nosferatu, or who looks like whoever that dude is, the Interview with a Vampire character, Lestat,
yeah.
You know? I mean, we have video games where you play Dracula's son, Alucard, right? We have Castlevania is a whole video game series.
Yes!
Where the whole objective is you confront Dracula. Castlevania is an anime series now.
I mean, even things that aren't directly vampires or anything like that, you can't really say that it wasn't influenced by Dracula.
Yeah,
I mean,
the
Avengers director and father of the early MCU in that phase one, I mean, I would almost call him, I mean, I don't know, Joss Whedon got his start with not just the crappy movie, but then the TV series, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah. Buffy was a huge
which
influence.
Was gender swapping.
And I, yes.
Yeah,
yeah.
That was
definitely.
Where she's.
Yeah, truly, truly gender swapping.
Let's have the cheerleader attack the monsters kind of deal. And
that's kind of a cool thought, right?
Yeah.
That, I think what's so fascinating to me is like just how international these ideas become.
Yeah.
You know, when we talk about like Castlevania comes from Konami, a Japanese company.
Love that video game, and I love the music on that first, like those early video games.
I was going to mention the music.
Oh, the music
crazy.
Is
crazy. They're incredible.
I've got it memorized, honestly.
There's also like a whole anime series called Hellsing.
On Netflix, right, yeah.
And Hellsing was about a vampire hunter. And so we see this cross-pollination of ideas. It's not just that Bram Stoker's Dracula was influential in English literature, but I think that we see that it influenced other kinds of vampire fiction, even outside of the English-speaking world.
Yeah.
And that is just, I think,
that's rare.
Amazing.
That is very rare for a single work of art to have that kind of profound effect.
Yeah.
I think.
And that's why we don't need guardians telling people don't read this because it's not good enough or whatever, because you don't know what it's going to do centuries later. You know?
Yeah.
You don't know what how
I mean,
it's going to fan
I've
out,
I've read
right?
some of the classics that they like to push in some of those things. And you know, like Grapes of Wrath, which is a really good book.
Love that book. One top 10 books
like
for
people
me.
Like in high school, they like to push Catcher in the Rye. And I'm sorry, but to me, Dracula is much more nuanced than Holland Caulfield and Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah.
I mean.
And I think there's a place for reading Holden Caulfield in school. But I also think that there's a lot more space, right, to read stuff like Dracula.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some of the things influenced by it. So I don't know. I guess my final question as we wrap up is I don't know. I think about where I'd like to see this go. And for me, guys, I think I have two ways I'd like to see this kind of evolve. One is get back to the original myths, like we talked about in the first episode, because I think that would be cool. But then I thought of something else as you were talking about how we can't like totally erase like how it's affected pop culture as we keep moving forward. Much like Wes Craven did with like Scream in the late mid to late 90s, that meta kind of deconstruction of the horror film as he reinvented it. I would love to see somebody do that with a piece of vampire fiction where they meta kind of deconstruct vampire fiction and pop culture vampires, even as they're redefining it and creating it for a new audience.
I'm sure we will see that.
Fascinating. That would be very postmodern. I feel like that would be very on brand with a lot of postmodern.
I mean, throughout the rest of our lives, we're likely to see never-ending reiterations of this type of thing.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Absolutely.
And it's exciting to think about what it might look like. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think very hopefully, at least from my perspective, I've seen that a lot of genre fiction nowadays really is trying to lean back on kind of non-Western, if that's even a thing, representation of myth or mythology.
Right, right.
And I am very hopeful that there are going to be some writers who come in and very seriously try to tackle some of this other mythology, you know, the mythology that isn't so Eurocentric.
Yeah.
And I hope, give us kind of a greater tapestry of vampiric violence than, you know, maybe we've seen in the last century.
Right. Yeah.
All right. That is it, everybody. That is our season. That is our five-episode jaunt into vampire fiction, into Bram Stoker's Dracula. That was, man, what a freaking journey.
What a ride.
I can't do that on a weekly basis, guys.
No, this was a lot of research. We recorded more hours, I think, on just this series than almost any of our other episodes.
Yeah, yeah. This series is almost as long as the rest of the season combined.
Yeah, almost. I mean, it's...
probably not quite.
I don't know that it's that close, but it feels like it.
We've got a big season 2 planned. We've already started planning season 2. We are going to take a little bit of a break. I think we come back first part of March for airing. And, of course, we'll be in the studio recording before that. Until then, we have the anthology out. You guys are recognizing it. You're seeing it. You're buying it. You're reading it. Love to hear your thoughts on it on social media. We have the novel out. We're going to have a call for submissions out this February. We're also going to be in the middle of a call for special submissions for an audio story to use for audio, an audio story, as well as put into Tales of Slay House 2022. So
watch for details on our social media accounts and on the website if that's something that you're interested in and you would like to hear your story read by us.
By the Slay House crew.
And put out as a podcast. So
yep. And we have a lot of things planned and we're just really excited to get this moving forward. So we have StokerCon coming up in May. I'd be very happy to be attending that. And we just, we can't wait. We're very thankful for all of you. We're thankful to our Wayne Howard Studios producers. We are, we're thankful to all of our supporters on Patreon and we're thankful to all of our listeners, all of our people following us on social media. We love you guys. Keep it up. We'll see you next season.
I just got a text.
I got one too.
Oh shit! It's from Charles.
Did we all just get texts?
I think we did.
How did you even get Curtis's number?
That's a good question. I think I gave it to him.
I didn't give it.
Well, maybe. What does it say?
It says Genevieve's in town.
Oh shit.